If it's happening now, we're talking about it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on 900 CHML.
Hey, it's Hamilton Today. I'm Curtis Thompson, Scott's son. Major Tom McKay is on the board. Wild Will Erskine booking the guests. And the legendary CHML newsroom, Dave Woodard. Here's Scott Thompson.
It is Hamilton Today. I'm Scott Thompson, 900 CHML. All right, what do we got? A jam-packed show, and I hope you hang around for it all. It should be fun. Some of the news that's going on. Oh, and, you know, like, let's talk about this, because we've, you know, obviously the whole issue in regard to the cyber attack at City Hall has been front and center. We were talking about this yesterday, that Mayor Andrea Horvath was going to come out today with a update in a news conference on what has happened. So it's fascinating where we are right now, and a little bit more information. The city of Hamilton has refused to pay the ransom to hackers. So that's a big news item right there. They don't want to pay the ransom to hackers who launched the cyber attack. This is almost 3 weeks ago now. The demand was a whole hell lot of money, said Mayor Andrea Horvath at the news conference today. It was a huge ask. And at this point in time, she said the city does not believe that anyone's personal information has been compromised, and that everything that is there has since been encrypted. So they do have a backup in place, but they have reason to believe that nothing has been compromised. And again, the big question was, are they going to pay? Are they not going to pay? There was insurance, there was this, there was that. So, and you know, from what I understand with law enforcement, and you talk to the Carmi Leibis of the world, tech analysts, once you do start paying, then in many situations, they've come back and hit you again. So that's where the city stands on all of this. She reiterates the mayor that it is not over yet, that there's still a long path to restoration ahead, and the bad guys are still out there. And reminding everybody, this is what they do day in and day out, and look for victims. And unfortunately, the city of Hamilton was one almost 3 weeks ago. So I guess the big news out of the news conference, things are moving forward. They're trying to restore. They don't think anything has been compromised, and that the city is not going to pay ransomware on this whole situation moving forward. So there you go. That's the latest from the mayor. And it looks like things are slowly coming back back to normal, whatever that is. All right. Also good news. Canadian housing starts up by like 14% over the course of the last month, which is great. Also, Alberta off of coal, and they use it for electricity. They're 6 years ahead of schedule for doing that, using Canadian liquid natural gas. So Alberta has found a business case for Alberta natural gas and getting it off of coal. However, there isn't a business case for the rest of the world or Europe, who is screaming for it and at war with Russia in regard to all of this. So we're going to talk about that story coming up a little later, and get into a little bit more detail, because, you know, at the end of the day, the plan that we have isn't working. And, you know, I'm not sure the whole environmental movement is knocking it out of the park here, because we've been talking about this. I've been doing this for 40 years. We've been talking about it for at least 30. And it was always shut it off, shut it off, shut it off. When imagine if 30 years ago, we just said, let's get the world off coal. Let's get the world off coal. Let's get the world off coal. And where we would be now if we had done that. And I remember having this conversation with Elizabeth May, and she said, too late for that now. And I said, well, you said that 20 years ago. So it's unfortunate, and hopefully somebody other than the rest of the world and Alberta and other parts of Canada, meaning, of course, the Prime Minister, will see the business case for cleaner Canadian liquid natural gas. So there's an example of how it works. So I'm not sure how much more clear of a business case you really need to make, especially when it's happening within your own country. So we'll talk about that. Also, Elon Musk, SpaceX company, has conducted a third test flight of the most powerful rocket ever built. They detonated it because it went astray, but they say like it is still an incredible success because every time they launch one, it goes a little farther and they learn a little bit more than the one before. So we'll talk about that with Paul Delaney from York University a little later on. Also, the Sound of Music Festival teaming up with the Burlington Performing Arts Center. This can only mean cool things. And we've seen when you have great collaborations in cities, what happens? The Grey Cup and Supercrawl, a great example of that. So we'll get the latest on that and what they are planning for the next year's event. Alberta phasing out coal. I've talked about that. We're going to, and they did it, 6 years ahead of schedule. We'll talk about that moving forward as well. And a study published today, the federal government's requirement that all new vehicles sold by 2035 be electric could increase power demands as much as 15% as we're talking about, again, moving off of coal. If you're going to have this kind of demand, you're going to need something. And we also know with every renewable project, there's a natural gas backup. So let's like have the big boy discussion, the big girl discussion, and do what is right as opposed to do what's fashionable and just get your votes. All right, what else we got? Oh, then we'll weigh into the Sir John A. Macdonald Secondary School site issue and where that is going. And also, you know, this was interesting because, you know, and we've talked with epidemiologists about this before, that, you know, people were getting vaccinations in Canada, and we saw with the pandemic that people were very eager to roll up their sleeve. And really, there was no demand to make it mandatory, no need to make it mandatory. And because we all had to wait for our age group to be called anyway. So it wasn't like everybody was like in the other G7 countries where they could line up for a shot. We couldn't get one. We were told we were needed one, but then we couldn't get it. So we're on our way to over 70% with the first injection, and the Prime Minister makes it mandatory, which, of course, now has changed everybody's view of vaccines. And as a result of that, kids aren't getting vaccinated as much as they were pre-pandemic. Why? Well, because when you tell somebody that they have to do it, their attitude changes. And now we're seeing measles at the forefront. We'll have that discussion with Dr. Timothy Sly, epidemiologist from Toronto Metropolitan University this hour as well. Did you see Elon Musk's SpaceX company conducted its third test flight, the most powerful rocket ever built? Many thought because it blew up that it wasn't a success, but this is a stage thing. And as long as each one goes farther than the last, you're making progress. Let's bring in Paul Delaney, Professor Emeritus, Faculty of Science, Department of Physics and Astronomy, York University. And here now, Paul, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
I'm indeed, Scott. Always nice to chat with you.
So this is considered a success. Is that accurate, Paul?
Oh, absolutely. The champagne would have been flowing at SpaceX last night very liberally, I have no doubt.
So this has been described as the most powerful rocket ever built. Define that. What does it mean?
The combined thrust of the stacked system, so the super heavy at the bottom and then the Starship that is on top, generates in excess of 16 million pounds of thrust. So that's more than twice the power associated with the Saturn V and marginally higher than the Space Launch System, the SLS that NASA currently has. So it is by far and above the most powerful vehicle that is in service it's not in service yet, but is being touted to be in service in the very near future.
And why is that needed?
If you want to deploy lots and lots of mass into low Earth orbit, let alone the Moon and Mars, this is the sort of power that you are requiring to deliver. The Saturn V, let's go back into history, took humans to the Moon with the Apollo system. No other rocket until SLS and Super Heavy have been able to do that. So the Saturn V was unique in being able to deliver sufficient payload to lunar orbit. And the same statement applies to now SLS and the SpaceX Super Heavy. Nothing else on the planet can deliver significant payloads, as in thousands and thousands of kilograms of payload to those distant destinations. And of course, we want to also go to Mars with not just a vehicle, a spacecraft that weighs 1,000 kilograms. We want to send people there and all the consumables. And that requires literally tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of kilograms of payload. You need Super Heavy and Starship to do that.
All right, Paul, break down this flight and how far it got and what happened.
So it's a two-stage system that they've got flying. The base stage, the first stage, is what they call Super Heavy. And that's got 33 Raptor engines, which literally carry Starship to an altitude of something in the vicinity of 20 or 30 kilometers above. That's the real heavy part of getting out of the gravity well. And it did that. And then the separation, what they called hot stage separation. So they fired the six Raptor engines on board the Starship, which is the second stage, and literally pulled apart from the first stage. Super Heavy then turned around and fired up its engine again. That's the first time it's successfully done that, and headed back for a splashdown in the Gulf of Mexico. That was the plan. Now, unfortunately, we're still not sure what happened. Literally, it might have run out of gas. But instead of soft landing on the water, they would not have been able to recover it and use it again. But nonetheless, the plan was to soft land in the water of the Gulf of Mexico, and that was the end of Super Heavy's mission. We got back to the landing site, so as to speak, in the Gulf of Mexico, but not at a slow enough speed. So literally, the first stage plummeted into the ocean. Not at significant speed, but certainly higher than was expected, because not all the Raptor engines relit. We don't understand why, but Super Heavy almost did all of the check marks that were required. Starship continued on, and the plan was to reach what we call orbital velocity. It was never going to go into orbit this time, but reach orbital velocity, which, give or take a bit, is 27,000 kilometers an hour. It achieved that. The suborbital flight was then going to conduct a couple of things. So the engines turned off the second stage, turned off Starship. They opened the payload doors. They closed the payload doors. And they executed what they referred to as a propellant redistribution within Starship in preparation for what they're going to need to do when they fly to the moon. Apparently, all that went according to plan. And we've got video showing all this. And then we began to re-enter. The plan was a splashdown in the Indian Ocean. And the imagery as we re-entered was stunning. You could see the plasma bubble form around Starship itself as it plummeted into the atmosphere. Then at about an altitude of 65 kilometers, we lost telemetry. And we are working on the assumption that the loss of telemetry meant the breakup of the vehicle. So it looks as if Starship did not survive re-entry, which of course is the most dynamic area of this vehicle's flight, with the exception of launch. Coming back through the atmosphere, traveling at 27,000 kilometers an hour, is hard in the best of times. And it looks as if we lost the vehicle at that point. So we did lose both the first and second stages towards the end of their missions, but all of the other boxes seem to have been ticked.
So they assume that it broke up during re-entry. It was not necessarily deliberately destroyed.
That is the current statement. However, remember, this only happened 24 hours ago. So we're going through the data. SpaceX is going through the data. Something else might have happened, but all indications at the moment, based upon the telemetry that we received and the visual imagery, suggest the Starship just broke apart during atmospheric flight. If something else happened, we'll know soon enough. There was enough data that was being transmitted. And that video, by the way, was coming back through their Starlink satellites. It was high-definition video. It was stunning in the quality. So we'll have to see whether or not there was something else afoot. But at the moment, the working theory is breakup during reentry.
Okay, so almost made it on both occasions. So how much is learned in that point, even though it doesn't get to its final destination?
Well, I'll go out on a limb and say that when they fly the fourth Starship, which will probably be within a couple of months, you'll see all of the boxes tipped. They've got three missions now under their belt, and they've learned from each one. As you well know, we didn't get past stage separation on the first one. We fixed that. We got past stage separation on the second one. Both vehicles flew for a little bit, but didn't get nearly close enough to their final objectives. And then the third mission, we almost made it for both of them. So the progression, which is typical of SpaceX, has been going from strength to strength, with literally, you know, pushing the envelope of the vehicles to destruction and then making them better. So the fourth mission, which I don't think will be too much in the future, the hardware already exists and is being tested in Texas. They just have to get past the flight review of this past mission.
Paul Delaney with us, Professor Emeritus, Faculty of Science, Department of Physics and Astronomy, York University. Another successful mission, even though not quite to the end, but certainly close enough with Elon Musk's SpaceX. Paul, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Have a great weekend, Scott.
Sound of Music Festival, teaming up with the Burlington Performing Arts Center for 2024. This sounds like a match made in heaven. Steve Cousins with us, Sound of Music Festival Board Chair and Acting Executive Director, is here. Steve, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I am very well, thank you, and thanks for the opportunity.
So tell us about this arrangement with Sound of Music Festival and the Burlington Performing Arts Center.
Well, you stated it very clearly. It is truly a match made in heaven. You know, this concept of the two organizations working closer together to deliver arts in our community, broader community, just hasn't gotten together until just this year, thanks to some great hard work from both the board of BPAC and Sound of Music, and of course, Tammy Fox of BPAC as a true advocate to make this thing happen.
So the Burlington Performing Arts Center is the title sponsor for the Sound of Music Festival. That's accurate. What does that entail?
So yes, that is very accurate. And it's not like your typical corporate title sponsorship where there's just a bunch of dollars thrown at it and the support of the brand. This particular title sponsorship delivers so much more for, we're confident, for both organizations. And it includes some dollars, but the larger play here is the collaboration between the two organizations, which includes physical facility, because of course, you know, BPAC is a state-of-the-art facility that has the chance to deliver all kinds of different arts and culture. It also includes all the expertise that comes with BPAC. So there's a big team there. You know, there's a led by Tammy Fox as the executive director. There's I don't know the hard number, but I believe it's about 10 or 15 or 20 even full-time staff that are experts in the delivery of entertainment. And so that is probably the biggest value this title sponsorship is really bringing to Sound of Music.
Well, again, now that we're sitting and talking about it, it seems like a brilliant idea. Was it difficult to arrange? How did it come about?
Well, you know, it's funny. You know, Sound of Music is a, you know, I am so proud, and I know my fellow board members are so proud of Sound of Music and what it does for our community each year. And, you know, festivals, as everybody reads in the newspapers, you know, it's getting harder and harder to get the appropriate funding, to get the resources to deliver world-class entertainment. And you know, last year we were able to put off a pretty great festival, but it, you know, it comes with struggles. And we, as a board, made the clear decision that we really should find a more sustainable strategic partnership. And that's when we met to discuss the idea that maybe Sound of Music and the Burlington Performing Arts Center could actually join forces and really deliver such phenomenal stuff to our community. And the first phase, of course, the best way to do that was to define some things, and we felt the title sponsorship would kind of answer that ticket.
And it's not as much taking advantage of each other's audience, which you can see how that is good exposure for both. Although I'm sure there's a lot of crossover there. It's really the advantage of taking advantage of each other's skills.
Yeah, it's a combination of both of those things. I think, you know, for sure, our reach in the social media world is, you know, significant. And that's a great audience that to the Burlington Performing Arts Center would love to be able to have a conversation with to help them grow their base as well, and vice versa. But it's the expertise that the Burlington Performing Arts Center brings in programming, in stage management, in the pure facility that we are actually going to be utilizing this year in our Sound of Music Festival, which will be a nice change.
And what are the challenges here?
Oh, geez, challenges. I think in the partnership, I don't think there are any challenges. I think that you know, our goals are the same, to deliver diversity and inclusivity in the arts in our community, and so, you know, we just need to manage each other's resources effectively. And I think if there's a challenge, that's really probably the only area where we would have to have, you know, ongoing discussions about where, how we can take the appropriate steps to ensure that neither one of our organizations struggle because of the partnership. But that actually hasn't happened at all. In fact, it's probably been the other way around. The volunteers and the team at BPAC and vice versa with Sound and Music are actually getting more passionate and willing and desiring to put more time in to make this thing work.
What will the public notice? What will they see differently? Anything?
Yeah. So if you, you know, one of the first things together we talked about, and again, using the resources of the expertise of BPAC and people like Tammy, who's been, you know, programming arts for many, many years, we looked at both our mission statements and, you know, they're very, very similar. Our intent has always been to be delivering, in the case of Sound and Music, music to our community. And the broader community, and it has always been about local, diversified, universal, and so we took the advantage of Tammy Fox's expertise in programming, and really tried to bring a festival this year that was truly delivering the kind of genres and types of music that all would appreciate listening to and having some enjoyment at.
What's the reaction from council? What's the reaction from the mayor and such?
Sure. So I can tell you that, you know, I have been in front of council now a couple of times. We've had lots of great discussions. They are advocates for this concept because it is it truly just builds a bigger and better community story for arts in the city of Burlington and in the surrounding areas. So there, you know, I've certainly not heard anybody at council say that this isn't, certainly at the title sponsorship level, this isn't a great idea.
And this is just, is this a 1 year thing, Steve, or is this a long-term commitment?
Yeah, well, you know, the contractual arrangement for this is this year only. I can certainly say that, you know, there's lots of conversation going on around, you know, making this, you know, more inclusive and for a longer period of time, and you know, whether it stays as a title sponsorship, you know, those are discussions still have to be had with both the boards. We absolutely, both boards see such significant value in this partnership that we are working very hard to see how we can make this more of a long-term sustainable relationship.
Great idea. It sounds like it's a win-win for everyone. Steve Cousins with the Sound of Music Festival Board Chair and Acting Executive Director. Good luck, Steve.
Thank you very much. And you just remember, Father's Day weekend, it's going to be another exciting, warm, sunny weekend. You should all be there.
All right, and you can find out more at soundofmusicfestival.ca. That's soundofmusicfestival.ca. Sound of Music Festival teaming up with the Burlington Performing Arts Center. The Burlington Performing Arts Center will be the title sponsor for the Sound of Music Festival this year. This is fascinating. Alberta, who most of, I guess even dating back to the mid-80s, still a tremendous amount of its electricity being generated by coal, is now phasing out coal from its grid, and it's about 6 years ahead of schedule. To talk more about this, Dan McTagg, president of Canadians for Affordable Energy, former Liberal MP, and here now. Dan, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I am, and it's good to be here. Thanks for calling in.
It's amazing that, you know, Alberta's got a business case for Canadian clean liquid natural gas.
Well, yes, they do. And since they're the largest producer of natural gas, but BC is not far behind, nor is Saskatchewan. In fact, the whole country has natural gas under its feet to a large extent, except for us here in Ontario. Although one could make the argument just south of us is one of the biggest natural gas deposits in North America, the Marcellus, where we still and recently have had a lot more of our natural gas derived from. So make no mistake, it's a trade relationship that works for Canadians, works for Americans, and works bilaterally. But the announcement that Alberta has not only met its goal, but been able to get ahead of that goal and convert its energy needs into natural gas, I think is speaks volumes about what the world could get if Alberta were able to lead by example and we weren't so quick to block pipelines, LNG in particular, to get our products to places like India and China and prevent them from having to build any more coal plants.
or even for that matter, across our own country so we could get it to other parts of Canada. But I digress. Is carbon tax, did it help this?
I think the amount of carbon tax that any user would have on coal is substantially higher because of its intensity. So, for instance, gasoline, it's 14.3 cents a liter. For diesel, it's 17.3. If I were to take the same energy equivalent for natural gas, it's only 0.12, so it's about 12 cents per cubic meter, which is about half the cost or the tax placed on equivalent heating oil or furnace oil, as we used to call it. But if you're looking at coke or high value added coal, it's between $145 and $220 a ton. So what does that work out to? It's about five times higher in terms of a carbon tax than natural gas. And if you're a utility, you don't get a pass. It's called the output-based pricing system, very convoluted, but basically utilities and others have to pay for this. So, and that's of course passed on to consumers. So big savings for Alberta and for getting their act together. This is the same province that 10 years ago built a diesel refinery that everybody thought was crazy and nuts. Turned out that we have a massive shortage of diesel in North America, and it had been for building and the foresight of building that particular refinery, just near Edmonton. We'd be in a real pickle these days. So, you can dump all you want on energy, hydrocarbons and fossil fuels. At the end of the day, you do need them and your economy depends on them, including those who think that in making electric cars and renewables are done, using pixie dust and other products that are not, that don't have emissions. They all require fossil fuels.
Why do you think this is happening now, even though it is 6 years ahead of schedule? And what does this add to this discussion, the fact that they did do it?
Well, I think it says that they can drop their emissions without having to be clubbed in the head.
Yeah.
I think it's in everyone's interest to have this done. And you don't have to punish consumers to do it. You do it because there's incentives. The incentives have been set up by the government to say, we'll use the proverbial carrot rather than the stick. The Trudeau government and NDP government coalition's position is, we'll give you a couple of incentives. We'll throw billions of bucks for the winners we think that are out there. By the way, they're going to have their lunch eaten when China decides to dump the market with cheap batteries. But we don't want to hurt consumers. We want to make sure that we're doing our best to ensure that we're encouraging best technologies. Alberta's a leader in technology. So we're the first ones to offer things like underground sequestration. They were the first ones to bring about fracking long before it's done in the United States. We came up with the idea, and long before we had to use these huge open pit mines for heavy oil, Meg Energy and others have created SAGD technology. So where the technology is there, where the incentive is there, and where the government cooperation is there, you're going to find results speak for themselves. I think we can work at these things, but it's very confrontational right now. And you have guys like Stephen Guilbeault going around finding trendy, cute ways to shut down economies and to have people live, in communes across the country and get off the roads and, don't live beyond your 15-minute cities. When you have crazy ideas like that and crazy actors, it's not very helpful, and it doesn't help, get us to that point where I think the evidence is pretty clear. Alberta's on a roll. So is Ontario.
So when we're seeing success like this, does this change the discussion in any way? Oh, look what Alberta did. Well, gee whiz, maybe Europe wants to do that.
Well, Europe's come to our door and asked us, as has Japan, can you give us some of that natural gas?
Yeah.
I know you got lots of it. What's your major malfunction? Well, our major malfunction is the prime minister beholden to a handful of climate fanatics coming out and saying, don't let them build pipelines to LNG projects. Look, Scott, we had 17 of these on the books and money that was up front. We pretty much shooed away every single one of them. In the meantime, Americans, Australians, Qataris, everyone else said, well, if you're not going to take advantage of the $150 billion a year that this generates in economic activity, we'll be glad to take it off your hands, you dumb actors. And that's exactly what's happened. We have a prime minister who basically told Japan and told Germany, nah, there's no business case. We'll get you some hydrogen. Good luck with that. It's extraordinarily complicated to make hydrogen out of windmills. you know, the bird choppers that they like putting on certain places that only run when there's some wind. That aside, we've lost a golden opportunity. I think Alberta is showing that you can actually do it the right way, and to each their own. Look, there's no wisdom like new wisdom. I'm holding on to an old little thing that was given to me by a friend who's long since passed. Township of Ontario, Pickering Generating Station, September 11th, 1965, to commemorate the sod turning, North America's largest and first nuclear commercial power plant. We did this stuff long before it was trendy. So I just like the climate actors to get out of the way and let the folks who know their stuff, who want to make clean energy, do their job without hurting people.
Dan McTagg, president of Canadians for Affordable Energy, former Liberal MP, Alberta phasing out coal from its grid 6 years ahead of schedule using cleaner Canadian liquid natural gas. Dan, thanks for the time. Have a great weekend.
You as well, my friend. Take care, Scott.
If Scott Thompson isn't satisfied with an answer,
he'll delve into the issue until he is.
You're listening to Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk,
900 CHML.
All right, a new study published today by the Fraser Institute finds that the federal government's requirement that all new vehicles sold by 2035 be electric could increase Canada's power demands by as much as 15%, requiring the equivalent of 10 new mega hydro dams or 13 large natural gas plants to meet the increased power needs. To talk more about all of this, Cornelis Van Acuten is with us, Fraser Institute Senior Fellow and here now. Cornelis, thank you for the time. I hope you're doing well.
I'm doing well. It's 17 degrees out here.
You can't argue with that. Good for you. Good for you. All right. We're a little envious today. There's been many discussions about this. Well, not many, but certainly on the fringes that, you know, whether it's mining for new minerals in order to do this, the electricity capacity that's needed, that some of these goals cannot be reached, although no matter how ambitious they are. 2035, everything has to be electric. You're saying we don't have the power, and in order to do it, it's a big ask. Is it possible to build the capability that is needed, do you think?
Well, first off, 2035, that's when all the vehicles that are going to be sold are electric. By 2050, all vehicles that we're driving have to be electric. So we're probably looking at 30 million vehicles by then, if not more. And just to reach the 2035 target, assuming that we don't have that capacity in place now, which I don't believe we do, we are looking at a probably, as you mentioned, a 15% increase. But in the longer run, we're talking more about like a 25 to even 30% increase in electricity capacity needed.
Are there plans to address those needs?
None. Not that I'm aware of. We are looking at in the short run, so we're looking maybe 2035 to maybe 2040, we need at least between 7 and 10 new hydroelectric facilities, large ones, or we'd need a whole bunch of new gas plants because, you don't want gas plants because that's fossil fuel. So, you know, you have to go with the hydroelectric.
Is the environment minister addressing the demands that will be made in order to reach these targets? I remember reading somewhere he said, EVs aren't the utopia here because, of course, the mining that's involved in order to get the battery minerals for EV right. vehicles is just as evasive as mining for fossil fuel. So have they even thought about the next step?
No, they haven't. They have a goal or, this net zero or whatever you want to call it. And they don't think about how you're going to get there. So it's, you know, pie in the sky kind of thinking, and the practical stuff requires engineers and all those kind of people. Now, I'm not saying that we couldn't ever meet it. The problem is we got to get around to starting it. And to do that, we need to have a lot more engineers than we have now. And we've got to basically turn our economy around and start building these plants, these electrical generating facilities.
In the end, it appears that these goals won't be met because of the reason you're stating, we won't be able to do it.
Right.
This is all kind of poppycock until 2035, isn't it?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Now, if they're serious about this, they got to start building today.
And again, when I point to the environment minister and in electric vehicles, he doesn't seem to be really wanting to build to mine the minerals. Where is the environment minister on building some of these mines that are going to be needed to even facilitate it on a battery side?
Yeah, well, that's a whole different issue that we assume that is going to come from offshore.
Yeah.
All right, that's one way out of that. But when you're looking at electricity generation, that's got to come from home.
Where
do that here?
Where are all of those involved in the electricity system on this? Is anybody speaking up about, okay, here's the plan, here's the goal, are we able to get there? Has anybody in the industry had this discussion?
Well, I think we talk about it in various places. For example, Natural Resources Canada came out with a study a few years ago that said we need 22% more electricity. All right, but to actually build it, I've read studies that indicate that we would need to rebuild our entire distribution system, all our transmission lines and everything else. And in order to do that, we don't even have enough trained engineers to possibly do that. So we have to, first off, increase the number of engineers that we're graduating every year, probably by a factor of two or three.
And these goals can't be reached with renewable energy at this point, can they?
No, I looked at the Alberta grid and I ran a scenario where it was 100% renewable and it would cost several trillion dollars to do that, which is unrealistic. I mean, you just can't do it.
That being said, Cornelius, what are your another news story today? Sort of deviate here. What are your thoughts on Alberta saying it's going to reach its goals of getting their electricity generation off of coal 6 years ahead of schedule?
Well, yeah, they just take out the coal and make natural gas. They just use natural gas. That's the only thing they're able to do.
So do you think this information is falling on deaf ears?
Well, I don't know if it's falling on deaf ears. It's just that nobody is willing to do to step up and do something. I mean, if I'm a politician, I'm only looking at the next election. I'm not looking what's happening in 2050. And my goal is to have net zero by 2050, but I'm not going to be in power or maybe even not even be around at that point.
So in other words, if you want to hit these goals, you got to start building power plants now.
Yes, that's the message.
Cornelius Van Kooten with us, Fraser Institute Senior Fellow. If you want to start going electric by 2035, you're going to need a lot more sources of power. Cornelius, thank you for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Okay. You're welcome. Bye.
A quick break here. We're coming right back.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
All right, lots of chatter around Sir John A. Macdonald Secondary School, the site of, especially as we are trying to build more housing and such. So the debate continues. What to do with the site? Who will get to decide? And to talk more about all of this, Todd White, Hamilton Wentworth District School Board Trustee for Wards 5 and 10, and with us now. Todd, thank you for the time. I hope you're doing well.
Very well. Great to join you.
So, Todd, what's the board's position on this? What are their future plans for the site?
Yeah, so with Sir John A. Macdonald, we've always had pretty high sights and high goals for that site. As you know, over the years, since closing the secondary school, our vision has been to create a community hub. So similar to what you just said, our efforts have really been focused on bringing education back to that site. But in addition, adding services like healthcare, affordable housing, employment services, recreation, et cetera. So all of those visions align with what we tried to accomplish a couple of years ago. But now it sounds like the conversation has drawn some extra interest from the province. So it's on to the next stage, which is bringing back some of these conversations and seeing what the next steps are.
So is this about putting a community type center, and I'm just using that phrase, but a hub, as you used, the term you used, is this about creating like a community hub, or is it about creating housing? Because it seems that there's two different objectives here.
So it could be all of the above. So I don't think it's a zero-sum game where one has to win over the other. So our original vision back in 2017, 2018, included a housing component, and there are different models where housing can exist on hub-type sites. And all of that is possible. So at the time we had engaged Qantas Housing, we also spoke with Hamilton Community Foundation, who was very supportive of a housing component. And as you know, in the media, perhaps just about a week or two ago, we were having discussions about adding affordable housing to Lake Avenue school site in the East End in my ward, Ward 5. So housing can work within some of these models, but it does require leadership and folks at the board and city levels to get to the table to sort out some of these issues.
It sounds like the disagreement here is with what the priority should be. For example, is it a housing development with a hub site component or a hub site with a housing development component? Because obviously, what is needed and what the demand is at this time is for housing. So can you see it being more of a housing development with less of, or with a hub component as opposed to the other way around?
Yeah, it's 7 acres. So I think all of the options are on the table. There, as you know, with housing, you can build largely up. So, I mean, you can build some tall structures, and some of the early architectural plans for the hub had housing going in that direction. So you can do quite a bit with 7 acres. In terms of a school, and that's what our board has identified, doesn't take up as much square footage as you would think in terms of a more of an urban style school. So that would usually be in the ballpark of maybe about 3 acres. That has about 4 acres remaining to do a number of different things with. And like I said, from a school perspective, we're not in the affordable housing business. However, as a landowner, we can act as a host and a group that can start those conversations. I think this is where, and we had these conversations a couple of years ago, they certainly need to be renewed, but that's where leaders like folks at the City of Hamilton, whether it's politicians or bureaucrats, you know, can really come to the table and use this as a community planning exercise to identify need, which could include multiple services.
So is this really taught about who owns the land, who controls the land?
Yeah, well, at this point, certainly the board has control of the property. But I think the message and the predominant message that seems to have transpired over the past couple of days has been the board is unwilling to have those conversations. And I don't think that could be further from the truth. If we look back, you know, to the beginning of these conversations, is that the board is the one that was the one leading the local groups to have discussions, look at the opportunities. So the board is certainly not putting the brakes on anything, isn't saying no to anything. I think the board welcomes those fresh discussions, certainly as the property owner. We have control of the property at the moment, but keep in mind, we could explore phased routes for development. We could explore severing portions of the property. There's a number of different ways to put together a community hub model. And that's where I think the board isn't digging their heels in. Yes, we had a proposal in the past, but certainly would be available to look at all available options.
Why has this not been done as yet? It's been sitting vacant for a long time. Obviously, there's a global pandemic in there. But you know, there seems to be a lot of chatter, but nothing getting done.
Yeah, and I think that's political will. A lot of the time, these types.
Is that why you're getting pressure, do you think, from the province? Is because there's a lot of talking going on, but nothing getting done?
Well, I mean, I think it's fair to describe the project as being somewhat dormant. It hasn't changed in recent years, but that doesn't mean we can't breathe some new life into the project, right? And I think that's where the ministry kind of putting pressure on and showing interest isn't necessarily a bad thing. I think it signals to us here in Hamilton that if you want something local to happen on this site, get your act together. And the board being the property owner, we're saying challenge accepted. Let's go ahead and do exactly that. And we're not saying we want to hang on to all 7 acres. We have to be our way or the highway. We're saying we identify some element of education on this site, which would likely be a replacement to our Hess Street Elementary School. But other than that, we're open-minded to trying to find solutions. And that's where I think at the local level, these decisions are better made. So, you know, use our city council and our board of trustees, other community partners to brainstorm on what we want on that site versus going through more of the provincial processes of property disposition.
I think the issue is here, Todd, those all sound like fabulous ideas and kudos to you for that. But I think the issue here is nothing's getting done. So what's next? and what can you do to get this moving? You said it's in the dormant stage. Maybe many are saying, why is it even in the dormant stage? Now, again, pandemic there. But so what's next? How do you get this moving? It sounds like everybody's waiting for the other one for a phone call.
Yeah, so I think we need to signal from our school board level to ask our staff to re-engage our partners. And I think the city of Hamilton could play a critical role in that. I can't speak on their behalf, but certainly there's opportunity there. In the past, one of our big partners was the YMCA. We had Hamilton Community Foundation. There was a St. Joe's component. So there was a number of positive components. But like I said, those conversations need to be restarted. So I think you're going to see leadership from the board perspective to direct our staff and our leaders to say, let's start these conversations. Let's see who might still have interest in this site and reevaluate what the next steps are. But I think the urgency around it has been identified. Certainly there are no winners when the site sits empty. So hopefully this lights a fire under all involved. But to your question, I think the board does need to take ownership of this and perhaps make the first move.
This is sort of a move it or lose it sort of situation, isn't it, Todd?
Potentially. And as the minister explained, new legislation through Bill 98 does give authority to the province to push these properties to the open market or to preferred bidders, as the process outlines. So that could be the case. The board could also start that same process on its own. But I think as a board, we have identified more opportunity and vision in the site than simply going down the list of preferred agencies. With 7 acres, it could be a multi-use project rather than just one service. So I think talking to partners before we simply release it to the market or to preferred bidders is a better conversation to have. So I think that's the phase we're in right now before we were to say throw our hands in the air and just simply sell it.
You guys got to get moving, Todd. Todd White with us, Hamilton Wentworth District School Board trustees for Ward 5 and 10. Use it or lose it. It's time that people want things done and action moving forward instead of more and more debate. Todd, thank you for the time. Good luck.
We need it, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
We're hearing the word measles a lot. And you know, we thought we sort of had all of this stuff under control, but in a post-pandemic world, the word vaccination means various things to various people. Our opinions have changed. Have they? Let's bring in Dr. Timothy Sly, epidemiologist, professor emeritus, School of Population and Public Health, Toronto Metropolitan University, and here now. Tim, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Yes, Scott. Thank you very much.
Tim, we've talked for the last 4 years. By the way, it was 4 years ago yesterday. I think we were all sent home. I forgot to mention that on the air. We've talked so many times since then about the pandemic and what have you. Are you surprised, Tim, to be talking now about measles at where we are with this post-pandemic world?
Yeah, one of the spin-offs, Scott, that we began to see going through the pandemic was the fact that other diseases, protection for other diseases was falling off. Now, you could understand that mothers didn't want to wait in line in the doctor's office with a lot of people coughing and hacking and so on. But in general, yeah, all those mild child diseases, pertussis, diphtheria, measles, mumps, rubella, the vaccination rates began to drop off. They began to drop off a bit before the pandemic because of some silliness around vaccines being dangerous or something. But then that brought it down even further. I heard just this week that 15,000 children in Ottawa had missed the measles, mumps, and rubella between 20 and 22. And this means we're wide open, we're vulnerable.
So is this about because our world was put on pause for a couple of years and we just didn't keep up with this, or have attitudes changed?
Oh, I think it's both. I think you've got some malicious anti-science threads going through the community. And it only needs a few, particularly with measles. Measles, if you had a competition right now for the most transmissible virus, measles would be at the top of the list. It usually was a long way before the second one, but COVID was up there as well, getting close to it. It's so infectious that if you have somebody in a room who's breathing that air and then they go outside for at least a couple of hours, anybody in that room who hasn't been vaccinated is likely to come down with measles. It's that transmissible. We figure between 12 and 18 people can be contacted by every single case that you have around, if they're not protected.
We talked during the height of the pandemic, and I remember some epidemiologists saying, or at the beginning of the pandemic, that, you know, even if we get 40 to 50% vaccinated, this will be a miracle. And here, you know, I remember going to 70% and then 80 with the first dose and such, and in high 80s for the first dose. Are you surprised that, considering we stood in line and waited for our ages to be called, and we're so quick to get the vaccine initially, and this is all even before it was mandatory, in some situations, and now we're kind of lax about it all. Do you think the mandatory thing changed people's attitudes?
You mean in general, Scott, with all diseases, or just with measles, or just with COVID?
Well, because of what we went through with COVID, now we're a little more hesitant with measles and everything else.
Well, I think you've got the dyed-on-the-wool people who saw the writing on the wall years ago, saw the particularly older people who do remember polio when it was around, and
yeah,
read, and anybody before 1970-ish when measles vaccination was brought in, you remember that there was a lot of hospitalization with it there. I mean, it's something like we have encephalitis, we have deaths between 1 and 3 per 1,000 just with measles alone. So if you remember that, these are the people lined up, just like me and probably you as well, to get the vaccination shot. If it's there, it's free, why don't you get it? What you got to lose? But there's a certain thread of suspicion and doubt and confusion that's been fed by some of the voices of darkness there, and it's causing confusion and hesitation, shall we call it that? And this hesitation can be a problem. It's not as much with many other diseases, but just to return to measles at the moment, that rate of attack rate means you need somewhere between, and we've done the calculation, between 95 and 96% of the population to be immune to measles in order to not have an outbreak. Well, we'd let that slip down into the 80s, in some cases 77%. So all it wants is a case from another country, and bang, you're getting what you're seeing right now. We're in week 9 now of this year, and just in we're in week 10. I don't know the figures for week 10, but week 9, ending March the 2nd, we had 10 new cases. That brings us the total for this year up to 17, which exceeds for the entire last year. So we're looking at the beginning of another, dare we say it, epidemic.
What is the message to parents regarding this vaccine for measles?
Get yourselves and your kids vaccinated. If you can't remember, and this is a failing of our government too, we don't have an electronic vaccination record. We should have. In this day and age in Canada, we don't. If you can't remember, if you had one or two shots, go and get a booster shot. Especially if you're traveling to another country, for example, Asia Minor, Asia, Africa, a lot of measles there. Get your second shot if you can't remember.
Dr. Timothy Sly with us, epidemiologist, professor emeritus, School of Population and Public Health, Toronto Metropolitan University. Get your measles vaccination. Tim, thanks for the time and insight. Have a great weekend.
Always a pleasure, Scott. Thank you.
When there's an issue, Scott is all in on getting to the heart of it.
This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson.
On Hamilton's News, Today's Talk.
900 CHML.
We certainly know about the situation in regard to the debate that broke out between those in Stony Creek regarding a parking lot or using it for housing in some form. And I think it surprised a lot of people that this turned into such an extreme discussion, and why there couldn't be some sort of compromise that, you know, obviously doesn't keep everybody happy, but certainly the majority of. But instead, no, it was parking lots are housing. Yeah, one or the other, which, you know, that never really leads to anything. However, there's a discussion right now in Toronto having the same discussion. Should municipalities be converting parking lots into housing spaces? Toronto considering the option. We know obviously what's happened here with the Stony Creek situation. Let's bring in Jesse Helmer, author of the report, Senior Research Associate at Smart Prosperity Institute, focused on climate-friendly housing and the real costs of urban sprawl, former councillor with the City of London, Ontario, and is with us now. Jesse, thank you for the time. I hope you're doing well.
Well, thanks for having me on. Yeah, we're doing great.
You know, it seems like a great discussion, obviously, if, you know, there's parking lots and is it the best use of land and this sort of thing. But I don't know, is there one blanket statement that can be made here? Because wouldn't every situation be completely different?
Yeah, to some extent, it depends on the circumstances. You know, I'm not too familiar with what's going on at Stony Creek to know exactly what the issues are. But when you're looking at surface parking, right, because there's lots of different kinds of parking, we tend to have in North American cities generally and in Canadian urban areas particularly, we've got a lot of surface parking lots, right? Surface parking lots at malls, surface parking lots in front of retail, surface parking lots at offices, and lots of surface parking in downtown cores, a lot of which could be high-density residential housing, right? And as the residential real estate market has really increased in price over the last 6 years in particular, I think people are looking around at these surface parking lots and they're saying, is this really the best use for this land, or should we be putting something on it that's much more productive that maybe includes parking, but then also residential housing?
That was my next question, Jesse. Does it have to be an either or, which is what's happening in this neck of the woods? And obviously, I think they're going to come to a compromise. But does it have to be one or the other? Can it be a combo of both?
Oh, it definitely can be a combo of both. And if you look at, you know, a lot of the towers that exist, condo towers that you see in Toronto now that are just a normal part of the landscape down near the water front, a lot of that, if you rewind back to the 90s, that stuff wasn't there. And what was there? Service parking lot, right? Yeah. There was a lot of service parking down there in around the Sky Dome at the time, right? There was a lot of underutilized land down there, and now there isn't, right? It's all been built on. And what's underneath those buildings? Parking, right? So there's a bunch of parking there. There's also now a bunch of housing. The key is to make it publicly accessible, some of it, right? Because for a lot of service parking lots, they're supposed to be publicly available, right? They're not like office parking for a building downtown, right? And you need to make sure that people have got access into those spots. So we're seeing more and more of that, of developers who are, when they build a building, they add parking for the people who live in the building, but then they also make a few spots available, like maybe 20 spots out of 100 that are available to the public, right? So that you can still come in and park there. The parking is maybe less than was there before, but now it's protected from the weather, it's underground, it's probably safer. You know, then people can still park in that location without losing the parking entirely.
Are you surprised this is becoming a debate? Because it does seem the solution, and again, every situation is different, but it does seem that solutions are close at hand.
Well, lots of people are solving this problem, right? And I think in communities that are maybe, they have a really long history of having service parking lots in particular areas, right? The people who use those lots, even if the lots are only half full, right? A lot of lots that are used in downtown areas in urban Canada, you know, the utilization at the peak is still only 60%, right? You look at the actual utilization rate, it's not even 100% of the spots are being used. And so you've got a lot of wasted space. But people who use them, they're in those habits. They like them. That's where they like to park. They go to their jobs. If they go to run their errands, they're used to it. So anytime you want to change things, people are like, hold on. I like this thing. I use it, right? So they there's a sort of inbuilt preference for the status quo among the people who are currently using it for whatever it's being used for, in this case, surface parking, right? And the people who benefit in the future, right, they don't necessarily organize the same way to say, well, hold on, but I need a house to live in, right, and come down. I think we're seeing more of that. I think we're seeing more of people turning out of public meetings and saying, well, where are my kids going to live, right? Yeah. And people who are in favor of housing and building more housing and maybe pushing back a bit against people who are saying, well, I need this surface parking.
Is how much of this is into the mix? Because obviously there's a lot of factors that go on here. It's not just parking spaces. There's lots of other lots, and they talk about infill and such. How much would this have an impact in a city the size of Toronto if they started doing this? Are there that many of them? Are there only so many that they can do this with? How much of an impact would this make from a housing front?
Some of it, this is why I say it depends a bit on the circumstances. If you've got pretty small parking lots, right, small parcels, maybe the upside is not that big. If you've got larger parking parcels where you can, you know, only acquiring one or two parcels, you could build a pretty substantial building. There's plenty of upside. And in many urban areas, like in London, for example, like there's acres and acres of the service parking. There's a lot.
Yeah.
There's a lot of it, and there's lots of opportunity. Some of it is, you know, somewhat impaired, right? You've got it near rail lines, or maybe it's built over a site that was, you know, it's got some environmental problems underneath, which is why it's a parking lot now, right? So it needs to be cleaned up. So you need brownfield grants and investments to clean up sites that need to be cleaned up for residential purposes. It obviously costs money to repurpose a parking lot, but it's a lot cheaper than all the infrastructure that has to be built to build a greenfield development, right? New roads, new sewers, all that stuff, right? Here, all you got to do is take away the parking, maybe clean up the site underground, and then start excavating and building, right? It's really, you don't have to add a lot of services. So it's much more You can go a little bit faster. It's cheaper. It's not like you're going to have to demolish buildings before you can start building.
One of the other solutions, Jesse, has been taking office towers that are maybe not utilized as much anymore and turning them or converting them to residential. Is that, how difficult is that? Can you do that, or is it a lot of a is it a much more bigger feat than we first think?
You can do it. Calgary's had some success encouraging office to residential conversions, for example, but it's, again, it depends a bit about the specifics of the buildings.
Yeah.
Buildings built in different eras are harder to convert than others. You know, sometimes we have patterns of building office buildings that make it really tricky to get the amount of light that you need to get into bedrooms. You know, if you're thinking about having residential, right, what's going to be in the middle of this big building that has a huge footprint and a big floor plate? So getting the elevators and the hallways and the light from windows to actually work, right, it requires sometimes a lot of money to convert these things and actually make them effective. But there's lots of candidates for that, right? And I think what we want to do is encourage the ones that are on the margins of making sense, right? If there needs to be some kind of public intervention to make it make economic sense, pushes it over the line into being viable. I think that makes a lot of sense. We're not going to be able to turn every office building, though, into a residential tower. Some of them are really just not well suited for it.
Jesse Helmer with a senior research associate with the Smart Prosperity Institute, focused on climate-friendly housing policy and the real cost of urban sprawl, former city councillor with the City of London. Jesse, thank you for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Thanks very much.
All right, we heard this week that, I guess we heard a while ago, but more talk and a vote crossing all party lines in favor of banning TikTok in the United States. It has to go to the Senate before all of that happens, but both sides of the House agreeing that this is what needs to be done. The U.S. government and Canadian government have both banned the use of TikTok on government devices. But as far as, it being used by the general public, here's where we are. And where does that leave Canada? Gordon Holden with us, Director Emeritus of the China Institute, Professor of Political Science, University of Alberta, and here now. Gordon, thank you for the time. I hope you're well.
Thank you, Scott. I am well.
Gordon, what's your thought on this discussion? Because my first feeling is, well, we went through this with Huawei and 5G. The Five Eyes decided they weren't going to allow Huawei to be any part of the backbone of that system. Is this any different?
Good point. I think there are some differences. And I have been changing my views on this back and forth several times. It's complicated. And the reason it's complicated is, of course, there's no equivalence. China shut down doesn't allow Facebook, doesn't allow Google, has just got rid of LinkedIn and the Chinese internet or intranet last year. So there's no doubt about it. China is a completely restrained and closed market when it comes to social media. There's 170 million users of TikTok in the United States, and I think it's some 22% of those check it every day. It's like a constant means of communication. Anybody who knows young people or teenagers know that this is a constant thing. You'd think it would be a simple thing. Well, it's a security risk. Let's get rid of it. But it runs into some barriers. And I think you're seeing now some in the U.S., Trump is one, who's backed off from wanting to ban it. But there are others who say, look, even if this passes the House, passes the Senate, signed into law by Biden, it's going to run square into some really tough court challenges on First Amendment rights, right of Americans for freedom of speech, and the limits on the U.S. government to simply seize or force the sale of corporations. Corporations have a lot of rights in the United States. So whether the bill goes through or it doesn't go through, there's going to be complex issues in play, and the courts will almost certainly be involved.
But as soon as this becomes a national security issue, doesn't that change anything? Especially the fact that, you know, China's upset and accusing us of bullying for even considering this. Meanwhile, as you said, no North American platforms are allowed there. Can you not just say national security? Sorry. And I'm sure there's plenty of evidence.
There is. The jury is out on which elements of national security are problematic. TikTok stores the data on Oracle servers in Texas. But if you're downloading, even if the system looks good right now, if you're downloading and updating the app, there is a possibility that malware could be introduced, and presumably China still has the ability to sift through and looking for things or people that are of particular interest to them. But having said that, I think one of the problems that's going to be faced is that this is an election year. This is an immensely popular program with young people, young voters. President Biden has some issues with young voters who aren't that keen on him. Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader of the Senate, says he's humming and hawing over this. And many of Trump's supporters say they oppose it. Why precisely? It's probably because of its popularity and some political calculations. There are potentially other things that could be done. One might be to force it to put out an initial public offering, an IPO on the New York Stock Exchange. Then the U.S. government could come in and pose all kinds of restrictions, perhaps a U.S. citizen security cleared group that would monitor its operations. That's not being done now. These are sort of some potential middle grounds. But if you're going to ban it, you're opening yourself to huge legal potential losses. That firm may be worth $200 million. Even people like Kevin O'Leary, the Canadian, is saying he'd like to put a group together to buy it. It would be sold at a fire sale price. China might not even allow the logarithms and some of the technical details to be exported.
There's another for months, years. There's another question, Gordon, is, you know, forget about what we think about it. Is China even going to allow that to happen? And, you know, Gordon, I mean, you know, I know exactly what you mean. I got a family that uses this thing. I don't get it. I don't care. And I have a hard time believing that it would becomes, when it comes to watching a cat video or national security, that we can't change people's minds on this, let alone not develop our own even better. I mean, come on. Are you surprised we're even having this discussion?
Well, I'm amazed there hasn't been, given the massive deep pocketbooks of US, like Meta, Google, there hasn't been a better mousetrap invented that would draw youth to that. And the youth seems have largely abandoned Facebook. They've jumped onto TikTok. It's got to be a better version.
Especially when you hear, Gordon, that the shelf life of these platforms is, if you ask the techies, oh, it's already gone. It's already done. Everybody talked about Twitter. Oh, it's done until Elon Musk bought it. Now, all of a sudden, everybody's talking about it again. They say that these things will consume themselves over time anyway. So is there not another next best thing out there?
Well, not that I'm aware of as yet, but I think that the American ingenuity, technological ingenuity, it's probably in the wings just waiting. Perhaps clipping the wings of TikTok might just give that opportunity. Right now, I agree with you. Things, given that turnover in the social media is so fast, that a TikTok might be passe within a couple of years. This might speed it up, however, and give others an opportunity. But right now, the bill says it must be sold. And if the bill passes, it would give it 6 months to be sold. I think that the Trump and the Republicans will probably not push this hard in the election so as to not alienate young people. But before the election, after the election, the security concerns aren't going to vanish. And that disparity between what the Chinese will allow U.S. firms to do and what the U.S. is allowing Chinese firms to do, that will still stick in the craw of a lot of Americans.
Yeah, exactly. So where is Canada on this, Gordon?
Well, we've done the same as the United States. We've banned it from the
government
use on government phones. If you own a government cell phone, you're not allowed to put TikTok on there. Canadian government has not indicated in any clear fashion. I guarantee you that our security agencies are taking a very careful look at it, but there's not been a Canadian government pronouncement. Australia just came out and said they had no plans to ban it. I don't think... it'll have a lot of support in the EU, but wait and see. I suspect that the Canadian side will wait and see how much traction this has in the United States before determining which path to take.
And they were the last to adopt Huawei not using 5G, so I guess there's no hurry there.
Well, it's better not to be the last one because you always look like a follower.
Yeah.
My general bias is Canadians, they're just as smart as anybody else. We ought to make our own independent determinations and then act on that, as opposed to simply, there is an advantage where you're in the same boat as the United States. But I don't think we want to be always the laggard.
Gordon Holden with us, Director Emeritus, China Institute, Professor of Political Science, University of Alberta. The TikTok debate continues. Gordon, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
Thank you, Scott.
Thanks for listening to the Hamilton Today podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 900 CHML and online at 900CHML.com.
That's it for us. Thanks for listening. As always, we leave it to you, the taxpaying customer, to have the last word. This one via email from Steve. It says, the police said to leave your key fobs near your door so thieves could scoop your vehicle without any face time with the criminals. Now they say, don't do that. Maybe next time we should just leave the keys in the ignition and the engine running on cold winter nights. As ever, Steve, keep right except to pass.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.